Okay, Parshas Tetzaveh, page 464. So just to quick overview of the Parsha. This Parsha is primarily known for the Bigdei Kohuna, for the priestly garments, but it starts off with something different. It starts off with the command to Moshe Rabbeinu to command Aaron, his brother, and the Jewish people to bring oil, to create olive oil, to have pure olive oil to kindle the menorah. That's the first part of the parasha. We'll come back to it in a minute. Then there's the whole main section of the parasha, which deals with the priestly garments. Then we have the third thing in the parasha, is all the preparations that were commanded by Hashem to go into, to prepare for the sacrifices that would inaugurate the Mishkan. Because don't forget, this comes at the end of the story of donating materials for the Mishkan and how it all needs to be prepared. And then Hashem gives a whole series of instructions of how the end product is going to look and what they're going to do to inaugurate and to dedicate the Mishkan. And then towards the end of the parasha, we have the Mizbeach HaKetores, the golden altar, the small altar, which was built and used for daily incense offering, the Keteris. There was a big altar which was in the courtyard, which was used for animal offerings. That was the main altar. Then there was the smaller golden altar, the Mizbeach, which was used for Keteris, for incense offerings. Okay.
Was that also in the courtyard?
That was not in the courtyard. That was in the area called the Kodesh, which was the section I talked about last week, the Holy, which had the three vessels of the candelabra, the table, and the golden altar. It's interesting you say that, because last week I explained about the altar being a place where you bring the animal soul, because we offer animals. So the incense was different. The incense was more about the inner connection between the soul and God. They resemble or symbolize two different things. Next week, I'm going to give a Purim shir, but connected to next week's parsha, and we're going to talk a lot about the incense and its connection to the parsha and to Purim. So stay tuned. I don't normally prepare the shir in that far in advance. I just came across something which I know will be good for next week. That's what I'm going to do. Okay. Sorry, I still need air conditioning. Okay, so let's just have a look at the beginning of the parasha, just a couple of psukim. So the pasuk says, "Ve'ata tetzave." It starts off, Hashem is talking to Moshe, and he says, "And you will command this B'nai Yisrael, you will command the Jewish people, ve'yikhu eilecha shemen zayizach, and they will take to you, they'll bring to you pure olive oil, kosis lamor, which will be crushed and will be used to illuminate, l'halos ner tamid, to kindle the continuous lamp." What's the continuous lamp? So on a simple pshat, it's talking about the menorah, which was kindled not, it didn't burn continuously, it actually only burned during the night time, but it was called continuous because it was kindled every single night. That's one meaning. Another meaning is that actually it's a reference to a ner tamid, which is the constant lamp, because in the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash later there was a miracle that one of the candles of the menorah, one of the candles of the candelabra, called the Neir Ma'arovi, the Western candle. Don't ask me which one it is, because it's a huge dispute in Gemara about exactly which candle is called the Western candle. But anyway, whatever it is, one of the candles was the Western candle, and that one burned 24 hours a day, although it had the same amount of oil as everything else. So it was just a miracle, it was a constant miracle. And that's what the pasuk is here is alluding to. I'll just share with you something interesting about this pasuk that I came across, which is an interesting idea. This particular commandment is to bring oil. Now, we know the oil used in the Mishkan was olive oil. We know that from many places. Yet, it specifies that it's olive oil. And also, it calls it Shemen Zayis, right? Which is in the singular, Shemen Zayis, olive oil, right? Now, that's not normally the expression that's used in Torah, in Tanakh, or in Gemara. If you're talking about oil that comes from a certain fruit, or honey that comes from a certain fruit, you use the plural. Like, for example, honey that comes from dates is called dvash tamarim. Honey that comes from dates, tamarim, not dvash tamar. Right?
So
or
they use the first drop of the oil.
Use the first drop of the olive, but they use many, many olives. They use many olives.
Right, but each one is only the first drop, so then it...
Yeah, I think that's learned from a different passage. I don't think that's learned from this expression. That's learned from the word zach, that it's pure. And the word says they're pure... means the first drop. Yeah. Like wine also, when you talk about wine coming from grapes, it's called Yain Anovim. Wine from grapes, not Anav, grapes. Right? So I saw a halachic reason for this. I'm not sure what the spiritual reason, but the halachic reason is like this. The question is, where do they get olive oil in the desert? Right?
Yeah.
I mean, they had gold, silver, that with them, okay. But with olive oil, I mean, where do they get olives from, right? Obviously, they would have to buy olives from the neighboring nations. The problem with buying olives from the neighboring nations is that how do you know if they're pure? I mean, the olive had to be pure, the olive oil had to be pure, right? So you don't know what you're buying if it's coming into contact with impurity or whatever the case is. So this particular commentary quotes a Gemara or Halacha that says like this, that if you squeeze fruit juice out of an impure fruit, it all depends how much you squeeze. If you squeeze a certain amount, a large amount, and it comes into contact with the impure fruit, then the juice also becomes impure. But if it's a small amount, then it's too... Because in order for something to become... You see, the juice, the fruit might be impure, but the juice is not impure, unless it comes out and has contact with the fruit. So if... You juice a very, very small amount, that's too small for it to become impure, and therefore it retains its purity, right? So therefore the pasuk was saying that when you bring olive oil, you have to make sure to squeeze each olive separately, because otherwise you're going to run into a risk of squeezing too much olive oil, and it'll come into contact with the potentially impure olives, and it'll become impure. So therefore that's what it's meant by saying shemen zayis, pure olive oil, but it's shemen zayis. You mustn't take it from zayis, you mustn't take it from the olives, you must take each one from the olive, the singular olive.
It
means come into contact with a dead rodent or a dead animal or a corpse. You never know. Or someone who's touched a dead body touches the olives. Right? The question is, you don't know. You see, in olden times when Jews needed things for the Beis HaMikdash and the laws of purity and impurity were as common today as the laws of Shabbos, today it's, for us it's just completely abstract and very, very, very difficult and complex. But those days it was common practice. People were aware and conscious of pure and impure. So if they wanted something to be pure, they'd watch it. They would know. Like if you have olives that need to be pure and picked off the tree, they'd know it wouldn't become contact with certain things and certain people shouldn't touch it unless they're going to mikveh, or whatever the laws were, right? But you buy from neighboring nations, you don't know what it's coming into contact with. You can't assume that it's pure. So you have to squeeze it in such a way where you're sure that the olive oil is pure, even though the olives themselves might not be pure.
Well, it's important this week with the berries.
Yeah. That's correct.
It's got to do with
bittul. It's got to do with the impurity. Tumah can only rest on something which has a certain size.
I see.
I've got to check what the size is, but that's why they cautioned only to squeeze one olive, because then one definitely won't have the amount to become pure. And then you separate the olive oil, then it's pure, then you can do the next one. So that's
and there's no olive trees like grew by the wells. Like they say, it was palm trees.
I don't know. That's a good point. I don't know. Another point always says, Okay, now, as we said, the bulk of the parsha talks about the bigdei kahuna, the priestly garments. I'm actually going to go in later to a whole general thing in the parsha, but we're going to talk about a few specific things first. So we know that there was this incredible mitzvah of designing special clothing for the kohanim to wear. We've talked about this in previous years, that the reason that they wore this clothing wasn't because God needed the fancy clothing, it's they needed it. They needed to have it so that they would be conscious of what they're doing. It's a famous piece from the Sefer HaChinuch this week, where he says, Achara Maisnim Shechalavavis, that the heart follows the actions, and therefore he talks about the mood or the focus that clothing gives to a person. That's why we have a concept in Halacha like Big Day Shabbos. We wear Shabbos clothing. Not that the Shabbos needs our clothing, we need the clothing in order to have that consciousness of Shabbos and all sorts of laws in Torah that deal with clothing. But the same thing with the Kohen Gadol and the Kohanim, the fact that they had to wear these special clothing gave them the focus, because when they were doing the Avodah, when they served in the Beis HaMikdash, they had to be fully focused and fully conscious of what they're doing, right? I think I wrote you this example before. For example, there was no way they couldn't remember it, because one of the garments of the Kohen, even a regular Kohen, was the Avnate, the sash, the belt, a material belt. But the belt was 32 amos long, which is 16 meters. Right, so when you wind that around the guy, even if he wasn't a thin person, he was pretty heavy. So when he was doing the avodah, there would be obviously a full consciousness of the whole time, brought to them by the clothing. But just the general concept of them having to wear special clothing was enough to build that consciousness, right? Okay. So how did it work? It worked that a regular kohen had to have 4 garments. The Kohen Gadol, the high priest, had to have 8 garments, and some of those garments were very elaborate and very thin. Now, besides the consciousness that it gave to the Kohanim themselves, there was a whole very deep spiritual significance that went into each of the garments, right? For example, one of the concepts of the Gemara says that each one of the garments of the Kohen Gadol helped the Jews atone for a different transgression. That means that the fact that the Kohen Gadol wore those garments and connected to Am Yisrael through those garments and doing the Avodah, doing the service in the Beis HaMikdash on behalf of Tal Yisrael, so that brought a certain Kedusha, a certain holiness, and each one atoned for a different transgression. For example, I'll just give you an example. So the Gemara says that the Avnet, the belt, atoned for impure thoughts, which have to do with the heart, impure emotions. The hat, the turban, atoned for the sin of ego and arrogance, because that's what's on the head. The ksainus, the shirt, atoned for murder. And that goes back to the whole story of Yosef, when they took his cloak and they dipped it into goat's blood and they said to him that he was murdered and torn up by an animal. So that's that thing. Michnasayim, the pants or breeches, more accurately, atoned for adultery and sexual transgressions. And those are the four that every Kohen wears. Then you've got the Kohen Gadol, who wears the ephod, who wore a special apron, and that was to atone for Avodah Zarah, for idol worship, because it was the ways of priests would engage in pagan worship wearing the special aprons. The me'il, the, I don't know what you call it, the long tunic, the cloak. Sorry? It was a blue sort of just plain cloak which had bells at the bottom, atoned for Lashon Hara, because that's, I think, the significance of the noise at the bottom that the bells made. The choshen, the breastplate, is called the choshen ha-mishpat. It's called the breastplate of judgment, and that would atone for distorted judgments that people would make. And the tzitz, the headplate, would atone for azuz panim, for brazenness or chutzpah, which is like comes across in the person's facial features. So that's just one idea. But I wanted to share with you a different idea that I saw in a sefer called Mo'er V'Shamish, one of the great Hasidic masters, and he says like this. He talks about the stones that the Kohen Gadol wore. Right now, there were two sets of stones. I'm going to show you something. I don't have the hand that one here. Let me show you the. Yeah. Look on page 467, you see a picture there, right? That's the apron, right? Actually, even better if you have a look on the next page, 469, right? This special apron that the Kohen Gadol wore was a very beautifully embroidered apron. It was mainly around his back and came to the front, not full way, as you can see. It had then straps that went over his shoulders, and from the part of the front they had straps also, and those four straps tied into the breastplate, so they went together. Right? So he would wear the choshen, as you can see in the picture, he'd wear them together. Now, the two straps that came over the shoulders had two stones. They're called Avnei Shoham. Right? The stones of Shoham stones, that were special precious stones. And they had, each of them had the tribes of the names of the tribes engraved on each stone. Six on each stone, right? Then the breastplate also had stones, and each stone had a name of a tribe. Okay. Also, in addition, each stone had the letters going across all the stones. There was letters Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Shifta, Yeshurun, I think, something like that. Right. So, extra letters, by doing all these letters, collectively, the breastplate had all letters of the alphabet. Now, I want to show you something. Hold on a second. Yeah. Okay. Have a look first on page 466. Okay. Pasuk Tes, verse 9. Okay. It says, "V'lokachta es avnei shtei avnei shoham." You should take two shoham stones, upitachta alehem, and engrave on them shemois b'nei Yisrael, the names of the Jewish people. That's one pasuk to bear in mind. Then go on the next page. Pasuk Yizayin 17 talks about the four rows of the choshen. It says that umilei saboy miluas even. You should fill the choshen with sewn stone settings. Arba'at turim, four rows oven of stone. Tur, he says, one row was three stones was called Oidem, Pitada, Ubarekes. These are three types of stones, Atur Echot. Atur Asheni, the second row was Neufich, Sapir, Vyohaloim. Atur Ashlishi, the third row was Leshem, Shvoi, and Achloma. And the fourth stone, Atur Revi, was Tashish, Vyoshvei, Vyoshve, etc. Right? So these are the stones. We'll see why in a minute. I showed you the actual stones, even though I'm not sure what they are. So the Mori of Shamish explains the following. He says, this is just one of the examples of the depth behind these big day kahuna, behind these stones that the Kohen Gadol wore. So he says like this. The point of Aaron, HaKohen, wearing these stones or wearing these begodim was, what he did was, as we said before, when he wore these garments, he drew down a certain holiness onto Klal Yisrael. And he elevated them. Just like we find with the halacha, for example, that when Aaron would kindle the menorah, right? So he kindled the seven branches of the menorah. We say the seven branches of the menorah refer to seven different types of souls, because of seven different emotions. And when Aaron would kindle the menorah, what he would doing is he would be affecting an elevation, right? An elevation on all the people of Klal Yisrael. So too, similarly, he says that by him wearing the stones, not just wearing the stones generally, it's not just that the stones or the garments had any special significance on their own. It was him wearing them and doing the avodah and serving in the Beis Hamikdash or the Mishkan on behalf of Klal Yisrael, he was able to affect certain things. One of the things he was able to affect, he says that what tzaddikim do, famous idea, it's called mituk hadinin, where you take the possible judgment that Hashem has when he's angry with us, and it neutralizes it, it sweetens the judgment, right? How does that happen? How do we gain Hashem's forgiveness, or how do we gain Hashem's favorable judgment, or how do we transfer or transform things that are negative into being positive, things that are sharp into being sweet? So that's done through humility, the concept of humility. You know that the Gemara says that one thing that Hashem cannot tolerate is ego. It says, "Eina aniva hu yecholim lavoid." Hashem says, "I cannot coexist with someone that's arrogant. If someone is not arrogant, if someone is humble, even if they've messed up, I can tolerate them, I can dwell with them, I can work with them," right? So humility, which is essentially the concept of giving up our own control, giving up our own egocentricity, and giving ourselves over in a subservient way to Hashem and to His Torah mitzvahs, even though we don't always get it right, but having that feeling of humility, or we call bittul, self-nullification, being completely dependent on Hashem, that brings this concept of bracha and mituk hadinim, the transformation, the neutralization of judgment. He says that was one of the things that Aaron was able to do when he wore these garments. How did he do it? He says what Aaron did was, he doesn't say this explicitly here, but what Aaron did was, Aaron connected, Aaron was kind of a connector between Moshe Rabbeinu and the Jewish people. And we find that before, right? When Moshe Rabbeinu was designated by Hashem to go and redeem the Jewish people from Egypt, he didn't want to do it. He says he has a speech impediment, he can't do it, etc., etc. So Hashem said, don't worry, you go. You will be the leader. You have to be the leader because you are the holiest neshama. You are the leader. You are the person in charge. But Aaron, your brother, will be a spokesman. So that's on a very simple level. That's on a speech level. But on a spiritual level, it means like this. Because what happened was, why did actually Moshe Rabbeinu have a speech impediment? It says it's because he was such a high level that his level that he was on was so lofty and so esoteric that it was actually impossible to be communicated properly. Right? That's why he himself, what he had to give remained somewhat cryptic. That's the spiritual meaning behind his speech impediment. But Aaron was able then to take it to the next level and bring the Jewish people to be ready to receive that kedusha that Moshe Rabbeinu was able to give. Right? In another sense, you can explain it this way. The Zohar says that just like by a wedding, you have what's called shushvinim, unteferers, people that take the chasn, people that take the color. Right? So too with the marriage between Hashem and the Jewish people. So who were the Shushvinim? No, Matan Torah was a marriage between Hashem and the Jewish people. Who were the Shushvinim? Aaron and Moshe. Moshe Rabbeinu was the Shushvinim, the Unterfira of the Chassin, of Hashem. And Aaron was the Unterfira of the Jewish people. What does that mean? That means that Moshe Rabbeinu's job was to bring Hashem to the people. But being Hashem to the people is not good enough. You have to be ready for that. So Aaron HaKohen's job was to elevate the Jewish people to be ready for that revelation. So between the two of them, they made that marriage. So therefore he says that concept of the humility that needs to come into, that needs to be infused into the Jewish people, that's the attribute of Moshe Rabbeinu. So when Aaron HaKohen was wearing the clothing, the big day kahuna, the holy clothing, and by then he was supposed to draw down these various different holy aspects of the Jewish people, What was really happening is, one of the things he had to do was draw down from the Madrega, from the level of Moshe Rabbeinu, this concept of complete and absolute subservience and humility to Hashem, and bring that down and infuse that into the Jewish people. Right? He says, where's that hinted? The whole thing. He says like this. The humility of Moshe Rabbeinu is hinted in two letters. The word Ma. There's a place in the Chumash where Moshe Rabbeinu says, V'nachnu Ma, what are we? We know that word Ma in Kabbalah, the word Ma means, what am I? Like, Ma always represents, the word Ma always represents that total given over. Like, Ma, what am I? It's like, I'm nothing. I'm nothing on my own. My whole reality, my whole identity is taken from Hashem, right? One of the formations of Hashem's name is Ma. You know, there's different Kabbalistic, you know what I'm talking about? There's different ways you can write Hashem's name if you spell it out. Like Yud, the four letters of Hashem is Yud and Hey and Vav and Hey, but if you spell it out, like Yud Vav Yud and Hey is Hey Aleph or Hey Hey, whatever. Depending on how you spell it, you have different formations of Hashem's name. We have the name of 42, the name of 45, the name of 63, the name of 72. Each one stands for a different thing. One of them is called the Shem Ma, the name of Hashem that is the gematria of 45, right? And that's certain neshamas, certain souls we are taught. Come from that name of Shema, and those are the lofty souls that are completely given over to Hashem and have that humility and that subservience towards Hashem. It's all hinted in the word Ma, right? Okay. So he says the following. He says, this is what's in the pasuk. Let's go back to that pasuk. I'll show you on page 466 again. 9, right? He says to Moshe Rabbeinu and to Aaron, "V'lakachta, you should take a shtei avnei shoham. You should take two stones called shoham stones." Now, in Sefer Yetzirah, which is the famous Kabbalistic work that explains the formula of creation, it calls it, when it talks about how God created the world with the letters, right? It calls the letters stones, avanim, because it says like two letters can form a word. Different words can form a building. It's like just like you build a building with stones, put them together, they become bricks. The bricks become walls. Walls become structures. So too, the letters are called the stones, that the building blocks of creation. And in Sefer Yetzirah, he calls them stones. So it's very famous that letters are called stones. Also because letters are nothing; they are inanimate. Letters are as good as the content you put into them. So for many various reasons, letters are called stones. He says you should take two stones of the shoham. Two stones, which are letters, from the word Shoham. Shoham called Shoham stones. Look at the word Shoham, it has letters of Moshe, right? So you've got to draw two of the stones out of Moshe Rabbeinu's name. Which two stones? Mem and Hey, Ma. Right? Take the Ma, take the level of Ma, the level of humility. Ufitachto Alehem, and engrave them, Shmois B'nei Yisrael, the names of the Jewish people. Isn't that amazing? Then he says, listen to this. He says, that's the depth behind these Shoham stones. You take two stones of the word Shoham, the Ma, and you write the Jewish name, the people's names, and that's how you bring down the Ma, the humility from Moshe Rabbeinu, Aaron's job, Aaron the link, into the Jewish people. Then he says, if you go to the Psukim, he says the same things with regard to the Choshen, the stones, which also had the names of the Jewish people written on it, right? The Shvatim. He says, if you take all the stones that we learned before, Tur, Oidem, Pitadah, Barekes, all these funny sounding stones, and you count up the letters of all the stones, I mean, all the letters of the Oidem, Pitadah, Barekes, the 12 stones, the law says 45. It's 45 letters. Also Ma. Again, so the stones of the Choshen is also the letters of Ma, and on that you engrave the names of the Bnei Yisrael. That was the process of bringing the Ma, the humility from Moshe Rabbeinu, and infusing it into the Jewish people. Torah is deep, what shall I say?
Six times 12 becomes
what, the stones?
Yeah.
No. The stone names, the letters.
Yes.
Oidem, Pitadah, Barekas. Take all the letters of the stones without the vowels and without the prefixes. He says you count them up. I didn't do it, I trust him. But and you count them up, you'll see it's 45. Right? Same thing, mine. That's the connection. It's pretty cute. Okay. Now I want to move to something general in the parasha. It's a very, very famous concept in this week's parasha. and it comes from the commentary called the Balaturim. And the Balaturim says that this is the only parsha, he remarks, I mean we know that it's the only parsha, but he remarks that it's the only parsha from the time that Moshe Rabbeinu is born until the end of the book of Bamidbar, right? It's the only parsha we read that doesn't have Moshe Rabbeinu's name in the whole parsha. You know that, right? Because you might have noticed that the beginning of the parsha actually starts off very strangely. Normally we have, when we introduce a new mitzvah, it'll say, Vayedaber Hashem al Moshe Lemer, Hashem spoke to Moshe and is saying, go and take oil, go and bring this, go and do this. It doesn't say that over here. It says, Va'atar etzava, you will command. And you will bring together our... It doesn't say who's talking about. We know that Hashem is talking to Moshe Rabbeinu contextually, but it doesn't actually have Moshe Rabbeinu's name in the entire parasha. Right? Why? So the Baal Turim says it's based on something that happened in next week's parasha. Next week's parasha, there was the sin of the golden calf. And in the golden calf, it says that Hashem was angry with the Jewish people. He told Moshe Rabbeinu, he was up on the mountain. He told Moshe Rabbeinu, Lech Reid, go down. Go and see what your people have done. They've messed up completely. I'm going to destroy them. I'm going to make you into a big nation. I'm done with it. Right? So Moshe Rabbeinu starts being the advocate of the Jewish people and he intercedes on the Jewish people's behalf. And he says to Hashem, you have to forgive the Jewish people. You've got to do it. And then he says, V'im ayin, if not, if you won't do it, he says, Mecheini no misifrucha asher kasafta. Erase me from your book that you have written. Take me out of the Torah, I'm not interested. So he says to Hashem. The end of the story is, Hashem did forgive the Jewish people. But we have a rule, says the Baal HaTurim, a famous concept, that killer last tzaddik afilu al tznai miskayim. That when a tzaddik curses something, himself or something, even if it's conditional, the power of the words of the tzaddik are so strong that it always has an effect. I'll give you an example. You know that when Yaakov sent his sons to Yosef, when Yosef was in Mitzrayim, and then Yosef sent them back, and he said, you didn't bring your youngest son, you got to bring Binyamin. They went back, Binyamin, Yaakov didn't want to send Binyamin, a whole business, right? So Yehuda says, listen, it's just not going to work. We've got to take Binyamin, the guy doesn't want to see us. We out of bread, he won't see us unless we bring Binyamin. So he goes to Yaakov, and he pleads with him, and he says, you know, I'll take responsibility. And if I don't bring him back in one piece, he says, V'chatasi le'avi kol ha'yamin. I will be sin to my father all the days. And all the days include not only this world, but the world to come. I'm going to be done. I'm going to be finished. Right? And the end of the day is, he brought Binyamin back in one piece. And yet it still had an effect. Because later on, at the end of the Chumash, when Moshe Rabbeinu gives brachas, there's a whole interesting cryptic bracha he gives to Yehuda. And the Medrash says that what happened was, that all the years, since Yehuda had died, all the years till Moshe Rabbeinu gave that bracha, Yehuda's neshama was struggling in Gan Eden. They wouldn't let him in to the yeshiva of Gan Eden to learn Torah with everyone else. Why? Because he cursed himself like that. And even though he did the right thing, he brought back Binyamin, but it had an effect, and Moshe Rabbeinu had to go through a whole process through his brachas to elevate him and to allow him in and to admit him until it was all sorted out. Right? So Kilel LaTzaddik, the curse of a tzaddik, has an effect even al tznai, and therefore it has an effect. So, right? Therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu, when he said, erase me from the book that you've written, so he wasn't taken out of the Torah, but it had some effect. And you have one Pasha that doesn't have Moshe Rabbeinu's name, which is Pasha's Tetzav. So the famous question is, why Pasha's Tetzav? Mm-hmm. Right? Why Pasha's Tetzav?
Should be the Pasha of the...
Well, first of all, like this. First of all, it's not so simple exactly when all this happened. The chronology of the whole Chumash Shmos is very interesting, but and lots of different opinions. But the flow of the Pesukim is that at this point, Egel Azov hadn't happened yet. Right? So some people say, no, that's exactly why. Because it's the next Pasha. And when Moshe Rabbeinu said, erase me from the book that you have written, he's talking about you've already written, which is the Pasha before, which is Pasha Tzaveh. So therefore it makes sense that he got taken out of Pasha Tzaveh. Okay. The Vilna Gaon says something different. He says something interesting. He says that Pasha Tzaveh always comes around the 7th of Adar, which is Thursday. Yeah. Right? Always comes around 7th of Adar, either before 7th of Adar or after 7th of Adar. Always, that's always the Israel. And 7th of Adar, of course, is the birthday and Yartzat of Moshe Rabbeinu. So therefore, if there's going to be one Parsha, doesn't the name Moshe Rabbeinu, it fits for this week. That's why he says, that's why Parsha the Tzavi was the one that's chosen. Right? Another Pshat I saw, Paneach Raza, says like this, he says that We know there was a famous medrash that Moshe Rabbeinu was supposed to be the Kohen. The way it was going to be is that Moshe Rabbeinu was going to be the Kohen, and Aaron was going to be the Levi. So in other words, all the Kohenim were going to come from Moshe Rabbeinu, all the Levim were going to come from Aaron HaKohen. But Moshe Rabbeinu got punished and it was switched. The Kohen got taken away from him. Why? Part of the reason is because he argued with God, he over-argued with God at the burning bush. He overdid it a little bit. He argued with him for 7 days and seven nights because he didn't want to become the leader. To resist leadership was a good thing, but he overdid it. And then he said, Shlach Nobi Atishlach. He said, don't send me, just send someone else, not me. And Hashem got a bit upset with him and he said, okay, you lose the kohen, you lose the priesthood, and he was punished for that, right? When you're a tzaddik, it's strict. Hashem is, you can't get it. Well, listen. So therefore, because Moshe Rabbeinu was punished, and he got punished, so therefore, there's going to be one parasha, says B'nai Achraz, that we're going to take away Moshe Rabbeinu's name, which will also be the one that emphasizes that punishment. So therefore, it's Parshas Tetzaveh. Parshas Tetzaveh is the one that talks about the clothes of the Kohen Gadol and the clothes of the Kohenim, so therefore it makes sense to be their parasha.
Because they had nothing to do with Moshe Rabbeinu.
Yeah, so kind of, like it's not your parasha, it's the Kohen's parasha. Kind of. However, what remains to be understood is not so simple after all this, because nothing happens by chance, right? So there's two questions we have to understand with this whole thing. First of all, it's all very nice, but it still doesn't explain the direct link between the content of having Moshe Rabbeinu's name removed and the fact that it's Parshas Tetzaveh, that all the things that happen in Parshas Tetzaveh. Number one. Number two, there's a problem with this whole thing altogether. Because if it's a negative thing, right, if Moshe Rabbeinu is taken out and it's kind of a punishment because he affected himself and all that kind of thing, and even we talk about, he lost the kahuna, and therefore it's sort of highlights a little bit of a negative aspect. The truth is, he didn't accomplish that. Because not like the Parsha doesn't talk about Moshe Rabbeinu. The Parsha talks the whole time about Moshe Rabbeinu. It's all about what Moshe Rabbeinu has to do. He has got to command the Jewish people to bring olive oil. He has got to bring Aaron HaKohen and his sons and make garments for them. He has got to train Aaron and his sons. It's got to be dafka him. He's got to train Aaron and his sons how to prepare for the inauguration of the Mishkan. So it's all about Moshe Rabbeinu. In fact, Moshe Rabbeinu is much stronger in this parasha than any other parasha. Why? Because how does it start off? Let's have a look at the very first pasuk, for example. It says, "Ve'ata tetzaveh." You will command. What does it mean? You will command. We know that a name, it's a famous idea, that a name of someone doesn't reflect necessarily the essence of the person. Right? A name is actually an external thing. Why? Because the person on his own doesn't need a name. Meaning, a name of someone is connected with who they are. That's why we say Adam Rishon was so clever, he was able to see the names of the animals because he connected the flow of energy with their personality, and he was able to work out what the formula was and therefore what their name was. That's fine. And therefore, name of a person, parents of Ruach HaKodesh and so on. But nevertheless, the name is just a description of the person. A person on his own, a person's essence doesn't require a name. The whole reason a person needs a name is the name is how I relate to someone else. Then I need a name. The name only becomes relevant how I relate to someone else. But a person on his own, my very core essence, is not dependent on a name. Right? When it says, Vayedaber Hashem Moshe Leimer, and Hashem spoke to Moshe Rabbeinu saying, it's referring to him by his name. So kind of it's an external relationship. When it comes to a parsha, Hashem says, "Ve'ato tetzaveh, you will command." He's talking second person. He's saying you, like the Kliyakra says that you means your essence, who you are. So the word "ve'ato" and you, second person and you, referring to Moshe Rabbeinu, is a far stronger reference to Moshe Rabbeinu than the word Moshe is. So, what have we gained? Moshe Rabbeinu says, "Take me out of the Torah." He's in here more than ever. Clear question? Okay. So there's a few actually, but this is particularly one sicha of the Rebbe about this, where he explains this whole thing in a whole different way. And he gives a whole different insight into Moshe Rabbeinu's connection to the Jewish people, Jewish people's connection to God, and so on and so forth. So let me take with you step by step. First of all, we need to understand what Moshe Rabbeinu, what was he trying to do actually? Let's just take that statement from Moshe Rabbeinu. He said to God, "You've got to forgive the Jewish nation. If you don't, Mecheni na, erase me from your book that you have written. We have to understand like this. Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't just like, you know, I happen to be in the Torah, so take me out. Moshe Rabbeinu's entire life was the Torah. He wanted to say, what does Moshe Rabbeinu stand for? The Torah. Torah tzivalanu, Moshe. Right? How do we start Pirkei Avot? Moshe kibbol Torah misina. Right? The first pasuk you teach a child, according to the Rambam, when a child starts to talk, there's two pasukim you have to teach a child as soon as he starts to talk, and that is Torah tzivalanu Moshe is the first one. Moshe Rabbeinu gave us the Torah. Right? According to the Rambam, when we believe in the 13 principles of faith, and we talk about the Torah being given to us at Har Sinai, it's not just about Torah given to us at Har Sinai. We need to believe the Torah was given to us at Har Sinai through Moshe Rabbeinu. It seems to be a very, very critical part. Moshe Rabbeinu is synonymous with Torah. He's one with Torah. So suddenly Moshe Rabbeinu should come and say, I'm prepared to disconnect from the Torah. I'm prepared to take me out of the Torah. Such mysterious nefesh, such self-sacrifice. And for who? Who is he doing this for? For the idol worshipper. For the Jew who was serving the Egel Azor. For the Jew to whom Torah meant nothing. For the Jew who went against the Torah. He went against Moshe Rabbeinu. He went against anything that Moshe Rabbeinu stood for. Right? Whole connection between Moshe Rabbeinu and us is the Torah. Whole connection between Moshe Rabbeinu and Hashem is the Torah. And Moshe Rabbeinu is prepared to say, take me out of the Torah. Right? But the answer is as follows. Although on a revealed level, our whole connection is through Torah, which means our connection to God is through Torah, our connection to Moshe Rabbeinu is through Torah, everything is through Torah. But there does exist a deeper connection that is beyond Torah. And this needs to be understood. We've talked about this before, but let's just develop it a bit. Understand it a bit. There's a Medrash that says that the Torah and the Jewish soul preceded the world. Yeah? Now we know whenever the Gemara says something precedes the world, Tshuva also says precedes the world. Right? A few things. It doesn't mean in time, because there was no time before the world. Time is a created thing, right? So what does it mean when we say something precedes the world? It means, precedes meaning transcends the world, that there's two things which are higher than creation, right? They're not governed by creation, they're not governed by nature. They transcend time and space, they're eternal, they're a concept which is completely transcendent and precedes the world.
So what did you say some of them are?
Torah, the Jewish soul, and Tshuva. Okay? We'll see how Tshuva fits into this also in a second. Now, then the Medrash says an interesting thing. But because the Medrash is using the imagery of preceding, right? Which we know means transcending, but the imagery that's being using is came before. So the Medrash continues that line of language and says, okay, we understand that the Torah and the Jewish soul, the Torah and Yisrael preceded the creation, but who preceded what? So who came first? Torah or the Yidden? You think so?
Jewish.
Why do you say that?
Torah was created before.
For the world, but not for the Jewish soul necessarily. Yeah. But the Jewish soul transcends the world. Jewish soul is not part of the creation of the world.
The Neshama made the Torah for the sake of Jewish people.
How do we know that? Says the Medrash. Have a look in the Torah. The Torah is full of Daber el b'nei Yisrael. Speak to the Jewish people. Speak Emor el b'nei Yisrael. So who came first? The Yisrael, obviously. Right? So what does that mean? That means that there exists a connection. Although we say that on one level we talk about the Jewish people connecting to God through the Torah, which is true. But on the other hand, there exists at a very deep level, there exists a connection that transcends the Torah. In other words, there exists a connection between a Jew and God that transcends the Torah. It's even higher than Torah. That's not dependent on Torah. However, that should never be, God forbid, a weakening of the Torah, because that essential connection is hidden. And what God wanted, he wanted it to be revealed. And the entire way it's revealed is through the Torah. So when the Neshamas are born, when we become created as Jews, the only way we have to reveal in a normal routine way, the only way we have to reveal our connection with God is through the Torah. And that's why we always say that we have the Jews, the Torah, and the Hashem, and the Jews through the Torah connect to Hashem. Yeah? But, says the Medrash, in essence, the Neshama is higher than Torah. The Neshama of a Jew is higher than Torah and transcends Torah. you can only come through Torah, because that fact itself we only know through Torah. We are higher than Torah. How do we know? In the Torah. Right? Same thing with Tshuva. Tshuva is also higher than Torah. How do we know? Through Torah. Everything has to be revealed through Torah. So our whole focus is to through Torah. But there comes a time where we break the Torah. Chas v'shalom. We mess up. And Torah doesn't allow us to move forward because we've broken the connection. So it's then where we have to reach deeper. It's then those moments where we have to dig and discover somehow, we have to discover that transcendent connection, that connection that we have with God, which is even deeper than Torah. And that's the concept of tshuva also. How do we do tshuva? We reveal tshuva, we learn about tshuva, we do tshuva through Torah, but tshuva essentially is reaching to the very deepest of levels of connection between us and God, which transcends even the Torah. Because Torah, at the point of tshuva, Torah is not sufficient, because we've broken the Torah. So therefore, somehow we have to reignite that connection and circumvent the Torah almost, right? Which is reveal the connection that exists between the Jew and God, which somehow transcends even the Torah. However, once we do that, then the only way we can reveal that and rebuild it and repair it is through the Torah once again. But first we've got to reach for that deeper connection, for that higher connection. Yeah, are we clear as well? Now, there's a saying that says, Tzaddikim doimim l'boiro. Tzaddikim are similar, they emulate their creator. Tzaddikim operate like Hashem does, right? Like Hashem wants them to and like Hashem does. Moshe Rabbeinu was the ultimate Jewish leader. The ultimate Jewish leader meant that he was connected to the Jewish people. He had this keshes, this incredible connection to the Jewish people. How was that keshes created? Through the Torah, right? However, that's true on an operational level, that's true for most of the time. However, it's also true that at the very deepest level, just like between us and Hashem, there's a connection that exists between us and Hashem that transcends the Torah, so too there exists a connection between Moshe Rabbeinu and the Jew that transcends the Torah. At the very essence of Moshe Rabbeinu. Where Moshe Rabbeinu is prepared to connect to the Yid, is prepared to give up his Torah even, because of the Yid. Because at the end of the day, his connection to the Jewish people transcends the Torah. I think a similar concept, there's a whole or another talk about it, but I once, in fact, I have a very clear memory of this particular sicha. It's a very, very famous talk that the Rebbe gave about the very last Rashi in Chumash. The very, very last Rashi in Chumash about, which mentions that Moshe Rabbeinu broke the Luchos, right? He broke the Luchos. He broke the tablets when he came down the mountain. And it's funny, it's not mentioned, actually it's next week's parasha, but it's not mentioned next week's parasha, this Rashi, it's mentioned the very last Rashi of Chumash, where it says that this is Moshe Rabbeinu, remember Moshe Rabbeinu for all the things that he did, le'enei kol Yisrael, in front of all the Jewish people. Says Rashi, what did he do in front of all the Jewish people? He broke the Luchos. How do we know it was a good thing? So Rashi over there says, because it's learned out from a pasuk that Hashem said you should make a new luchos to replace the first ones, asher shibarto, that you broke. And the word asher is like the word yashakoyach. That's what we learned, that's where the word yashakoyach comes from. Right? Because Hashem said to Moshe Rabbeinu, yasher kechach shibarto, good on you that you broke the luchos. What was so good about it? So what happened was like this, Moshe Rabbeinu, he came down the mountain and he saw the Jewish people serving the egel as well. So he broke the luchos. What did he broke the luchos for? So there's a very fascinating medrash. The fascinating medrash says like this. You know what happened was like this. It gives an analogy. An analogy of a king that went away and he left his betrothed wife. He's engaged to a betrothed wife, meaning that the wife was legally married to him. And he went away and the wife wasn't faithful. And she lived with another man or whatever the case was. So the king was going to come back. So they knew the king comes back, it's going to be terrible. He's going to be absolutely furious. So the Shushbini, one of the Unterfuhrers, says, one of the attendants of the king, who was very compassionate towards the wife over there. What did he do? He got up and he tore the ksuba. He took the marriage document and he tore it up, so to speak, to annul the marriage. So that's it. So she's free. She didn't annul. She didn't break anything. She wasn't unfaithful. She wasn't married. Finished. Okay. So too it says Moshe Rabbeinu came down the mountain and he saw the Kala, he saw the bride of Hashem being unfaithful. So what did he do? He took the marriage document, which is the Torah, and he broke it. Finished. So one time there was a, the Rebbe spoke, he used to have a Fabrein in every Simchas Torah before Hakafas. The way the system was in 770, that on the night of Simchas Torah the Rebbe would daven Ma'ariv and then they would stop and he would go back to his room and then there was a break, and then he would have a Fabrein before Hakafas. The Rebbe Fabrein went until about 12 o'clock at night, then Hakafas he started like around 1 o'clock in the morning. That was the Seder, right? And that was a very, very special Fabrein always, because it was that Fabrein that the Rebbe would often talk very deep things and talk about the greatness of Jews. Because Simchas Torah is also about that. Simchas Torah is about the whole kesher between the Jew and the Hashem and the whole end of Tishrei and look at everything. And very often he would cry with that Fabrein. It was like a very fascinating thing. He would often say things. So I remember that was just, it was actually the Chol HaMoed Sukkos. That Sukkos I became engaged in. I remember it was like, and we had a whole Shmini Atzeres meal. It was a big celebration. Our parents were there. And then we went later to the 770. I never had this Fabrein. And he said that Sikha. And he started to cry. It was like it was such an amazing scene. It was like a very, very famous Sikha. About the mysterious nefesh, the self-sacrifice that Moshe Rabbeinu had for a Jew, that he's prepared to break the Torah to save the Jew. Amazing thing. That's a leader, a Jewish leader. He was prepared to bat for the Jewish people to the extent he's prepared to give up everything that he stood for. He was prepared to break the Torah to save the Jew. Amazing thing. Right. So the same thing over here. He's prepared to break. Why? Why is he prepared to do that? Because ultimately, as much as he stood for Torah, his essence was the connection to the Jew. In the same way that the Jew is connected to Hashem. Ultimately, that connection cannot be broken, even when the Torah is broken. Right? So Moshe Rabbeinu comes to Hashem and he says the following. Hashem says, you've got the Jew down there that's broken, that serving idols. Lech Rei, go down. In fact, Lech Rei, when Hashem told him to go down, it wasn't just a physical thing. Rashi says it was a spiritual thing as well. He says, you got to go down. You're going to experience a descent now. Because Taka, you're so connected to the Jews. And the Jews have fallen. So therefore you fall with them. Right? And go. And I'm absolutely upset. Because it's Avodah Zarah. It's the ultimate rebellion of Hashem. And so on and so forth. Moshe Rabbeinu says, no way. He says, yes, you're right. As far as Torah is concerned, there's no atonement. They've broken the most basic and fundamental tenet of the Torah. And from the Torah perspective, they finished. And I, who stand for the Torah, there's a problem. But he says to Hashem, I'm not letting you go, because there's a deeper connection. Moshe Rabbeinu, as Moshe Rabbeinu, if you want to describe me, what I am, I'm Moshe Rabbeinu. But I have a deeper essence to me, which cannot be described. And my deeper essence, my real core of who I am, says Moshe Rabbeinu, I'm connected to the Jew, notwithstanding the Torah. So therefore, it's not just a thing, you know, take me out, I'm frustrated, take me out of the Torah. It's a much, much deeper thing. If you can find atonement through the Torah, mecheni nom sifrecha, take me out of the Torah. Reveal a deeper level in me. Reveal my deeper connection that I have with the Jew that is deeper than Torah, which will in turn reveal a deeper connection that the Jew has with you. That cannot be broken notwithstanding the Torah. Go to a deeper level of the relationship between you, God, and the Jewish people. Do that by revealing how connected I am with him. By revealing that I'm prepared to give up the whole thing that I apparently stand for, which is the Torah, in order to reveal a deeper level of what I stand for, which is that my core essence of who I am, that will in turn bring out the deeper connection that you have with the Jew, and it'll find a way to bring them atonement. The Torah will stand in the way of their atonement, but the deeper connection, the tshuva, which is will reveal that essential relationship, will reveal the atonement. Of course, then it will have to be brought back into the Torah, because ultimately everything has to go through the equation of Torah, but it will bring it out. Now we can understand why in Parshas Tetzaveh, Moshe Rabbeinu is not mentioned, but he's more mentioned. But he's mentioned at a deeper level. It's not mentioned. It's not that there's an omission here. On the contrary, Parshas Tetzaveh has Moshe Rabbeinu, yes, it's the fulfillment of Moshe Rabbeinu's curse, take me out of the Torah. But actually it's a positive thing, not a negative thing. It's much deeper. It's the one Parsha where Moshe Rabbeinu was able to, he was able to reveal a deeper connection between the Jewish people and Hashem to gain and achieve the atonement of the Egel Azov, and that's why he's not mentioned by name, but he's mentioned in a deeper way. It's Ve'ata Tetzaveh, it's you, Moshe Rabbeinu, the essence of Moshe Rabbeinu is revealed in this week's Parsha. A much deeper level of Moshe Rabbeinu. What's it going to do with Parsha Tetzaveh? So that's what we understand why it's more mentioned. So it's a greatness, not a weakness, right? Why is it? What's it going to do with Parshat Tzaveh? What is Parshat Tzaveh? Parshat Tzaveh is how Hashem is telling Moshe Rabbeinu, you have to bring oil so that Aaron can light the menorah. You have to go bring Aaron that he can, you know, bring the clothing, etc., etc. Right? So it's a little bit like we said before. What is the whole thing of Aaron? Aaron elevates the Jewish people. Aaron brings bracha to the Jewish people. Aaron connects them to what Moshe Rabbeinu stands for, and he's bringing an elevation. But the problem is that connection is limited. Aaron doesn't have the power to elevate every Jew. Aaron goes and he kindles the menorah, right? First part of the parasha. Or Aaron does services to represent the Jewish people and bring them atonement. But who can he do it? Aaron is operating within the system of Torah. So therefore, Aaron can only do it and elevate that Jew which is ready to be elevated. The Jew that has completely rejected the Torah is not going to be elevated through Aaron's service. Aaron is ready to reach out, but reach out as someone who's ready. Says the Torah, in this week's parasha, the Mishkan has to be built for everyone. And everyone's got to have a chance through the Mishkan. And how's that going to work? Ve'ata tetzaveh. You, Moshe Rabbeinu, with your essence and your essential connection of leadership to the Jewish people, you're going to have to bring Aaron on the page. And if you do it, you'll bring along every single Jew. Which is why the parasha ends with the altar of the incense. The altar of the incense was an interesting thing. Incense was brought every single day of the Beis HaMikdash. And incense, we'll leave it for next week to do this in detail, but incense represents the connection between the soul and Hashem. But you know, there were 11 spices that we had to be brought on the altar every day. They were ground together, 11 spices. One of them was called Chelbono. Chelbono was a terribly smelling spice on its own. And it had to be part of the concoction. And the halacha was so strict that if one of the spices were missing, an Aaron or any of the Kohanim brought one of the brought incense with missing one of the ingredients, it was like a capital punishment. It was a terrible avera. Why would we put into the spices one of the spices that doesn't smell? The whole thing was to have a good aroma. Because the Ketores is about the connection between the Jew and Hashem, and even the Chelbon has to be in there. And if the Chelbon is not there, it's not complete. If every Neshama is not there, even the worst, how does that work? How can the worst Neshama who's rejected everything in the Torah still reconnect? Through the essence of Moshe Rabbeinu, through the essential connection. That's why that's also in this parasha. And that's why this thing about Moshe Rabbeinu's naming lacking in the parasha has a specific direct content connection to the parasha and to all the things in the parasha. And although it doesn't talk about Moshe Rabbeinu, but it talks even more about Moshe Rabbeinu, because it's not a weakness, it's actually a strength. It's about the essence of Moshe Rabbeinu that was able to atone for the Jewish people in a much, much greater way.